Whom does God approve? The context, structure, purpose, and exegesis of Matthew's Beatitudes. Criswell Theological Review, Volume 6.1, 1992, pages 29 to 42, by David L. Turner. Introduction. Whom does God approve? I suspect that Jesus' answer to this question goes against the flow of American evangelical, quote, pop theology, end quote. For instance, in certain evangelical circles, it seems to be assumed that widespread popularity is tantamount to divine approval. But the Sermon on the Mount, hereafter SOM, indicates otherwise, teaching that those whom God approves may be a persecuted minority. Matthew chapter 5, verses 10 through 12, and 7, verses 13 and 14. In other evangelical contexts, one gathers that attention to human rules and traditions ensures God's blessing, but Jesus' denunciation of Pharisaic externalism applies equally well to evangelical legalism, Matthew 5:20. Elsewhere, the focus is on material possessions as proof of divine endorsement, but Jesus strictly prohibits that sort of priority and values, Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 to 21 and 6:33. Another current teaching sees divine approval in extraordinary displays of power, but Jesus' chilling words about what might eventuate on Judgment Day refutes this notion, Matthew chapter 7, verses 22 to 23. And there are those today whose emphasis on spiritual knowledge implies that God must inevitably congratulate those who have memorized the most Bible verses. But knowledge alone is a foundation of sand if it does not lead to ethical obedience, Matthew chapter 7, verses 26 and 7. No, being popular, keeping rules, having possessions, doing miracles, and acquiring knowledge are not necessarily marks of God's approval. According to Jesus, God approves those who turn to him when they hear the message of his rule, Matthew chapter 3, verse 2, chapter 4, verse 17, chapter 10, verse 7, chapter 13, verse 19, and chapter 24, verse 14. Their turning is marked by the character traits summarized by Jesus in the Beatitudes, Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 through 12. These character traits are gracious gifts which result from God's approval. Compare Matthew chapter 11, verses 25 to 27, chapter 13, 11, and 16, 17, not requirements of performance which merits God's approval. However, those who have repented should cultivate these characteristics. Compare Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 to 29, chapter 13, 23, and 16, 24. Each beatitude contains a pronouncement concerning who is blessed, backed up by a promise concerning why they are blessed. These qualities, which God does approve, are explained in two sets of four, describing relating to God and relating to other people, respectively. Compare Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 through 40. He approves those who relate to him by admitting their spiritual poverty and mourning over their sin, humbly seeking spiritual fullness, chapter 5, verses 3 to 6. He approves those who relate to others mercifully and purely as peacemakers, even though they may be persecuted for their righteous behavior, chapter 5, verses 7 through 10. Such is the argument of this study in brief. It is developed by addressing the context, structure, purpose, and exegesis of the Beatitudes. But before these main issues can be developed, three preliminary matters, the complexity, historicity, and familiarity of the Beatitudes, call for brief comments. An immense amount of scholarly material has been written on the SOM, or Sermon on the Mount, in general, and on the Beatitudes in particular. Harrington does not exaggerate when he says, quote, "The history of the sermon's interpretation is a miniature history of Christianity," end quote. Kissinger's bibliography of materials on the SOM, published by 1975, ran to nearly 150 pages, and over 30 pages of this bibliography, are devoted to the Beatitudes. A computerized database I recently consulted listed 90 additional studies of the Beatitudes published since 1975. The profundity of the Beatitudes and the plethora of discussions means that this study can only introduce the complex issues at hand. One of these complex matters is historicity. The SOM does not appear as such in Mark, and appears only partially in Luke, chapter 6, verses 17 through chapter 7, verse 1. Luke 6, 20 through 24 contains four Beatitudes, which more or less parallel some of Matthew's nine Beatitudes, with the notable exception that Luke's version is a second person and Matthew's version is a third person, except for chapter 5, verse 11. Several theories exist to explain this aspect of the synoptic problem. Many believe that Matthew has created the Sermon on the Mount from traditions, documentary sources, and his own ingenuity, so that the Sermon on the Mount should not be attributed to the historical Jesus. Evangelicals have properly rejected this dehistoricizing approach and have generally opted for one of two following viewpoints. One is that Matthew has created the structure of the Sermon on the Mount by collating various teachings of the historical Jesus, which were originally uttered in various contexts. The other is that Matthew accurately records the, quote, gist, end quote, ipsissima vox, of the historical sermon which Jesus actually uttered on a mountain, so that the structure of the Sermon on the Mount is dominical, not redactional. The later view will be assumed in the present study. The tradition history of the Beatitudes is generally viewed today from the perspective that Matthew has redacted Luke or the traditions used by Luke. Whatever the merit of this approach, the present study will take a literary critical slant, focusing on Matthew's narrative as whole and the Beatitudes as part of it. But another matter is more serious than complexity and even historicity. It is the familiarity of the Beatitudes. The most dangerous passages of the Bible are the familiar ones, because we do not really listen to them. The sharp stone of God's Word, smoothed down by the river of time, no longer cuts. Instead of being challenged by hard thought or hard choices, we lean back and savor pretty words and spiritual bonbons. When reflecting on the Beatitudes, one runs the risk of missing the impact of their radical message because of their commonplace occurrence and pretty packaging. In this manner, dominical Beatitudes can become hackneyed cliches, shaking the beatitudinal kaleidoscope, yet one more time in this study must lead beyond mere visual and intellectual gratification to a realignment of our fundamental values with those of Jesus. Context. After his unique story of Jesus' infancy, Matthew chapters 1 and 2, Matthew develops the body of his gospel as five blocks of narrative discourse material. Chapters 3 through 7, chapters 8 through 10, chapter 11 through 13, chapter 14 through 18, and chapters 19 through 25, and then concludes with Jesus' death, resurrection, and mission mandate in chapters 26 through 28. The narratives focus on Jesus' works, the discourses on his words. The five sections of Jesus' works and words are divided by the key phrase, kai agenata hata etelesen ha Jesus. Quote, and it came to pass about when Jesus had finished, end quote. Chapter 7, verse 28, chapter 11, verse 1, chapter 13, 55, chapter 19, verse 1, and chapter 26, verse 1. The discourse, which has been called the SOM, or Sermon on the Mount, since the time of Augustine, Matthew chapter 5 through 7, should be seen as the representative ethical teaching of Jesus. It unpacks the summary statement of chapter 4, verse 23, which presents a words/works complex. Thus, 4:23 and the similar summary in chapter 9, verse 35 provide an inclusio which envelops or Jesus' ministry of teaching, chapter 5 through 7, and doing miracles, chapter 8 through 9. Both the words and the works demonstrate the authority of the kingdom of heaven, chapter 7 verses 28 through 29, chapter 8 verses 8 through 9, chapter 9 verses 6 through 8. The SOM is summarized and displayed in chart 1 as follows. Chart 1, Display and Summary of the Sermon on the Mount. Introductory Narrative Framework, Chapter 5, Verses 1 through 2. Jesus is prompted to teach by the crowds, and his disciples gather around him to hear his teaching. Introduction to the Sermon, Beatitudes, Chapter 5, Verses 3 through 16. The Beatitudes describe the divinely approved lifestyle of those who have repented at the arrival of the rule of God in Jesus' words and works. Body, chapter 5, verses 17 through chapter 7, verse 12. Jesus announces, chapters 5, verses 17 through 20, and then explains his/and his disciples' relationship to the law with six contrasts, chapter 5, verses 21 through 48. Then he turns to hypocritical versus genuine religious practice in chapter 6, verses 1 to 18. Materialism and anxiety in chapter 6, verses 19 through 34. And relating to people, chapter 7, verses 1 through 12. The reference to the law, chapter 7, verse 12, provides another enveloping inclusio, which completes the theme of obeying the law and prophets, which began in chapter 5, 17. Conclusion, chapter 7, verses 13 through 27. Here, three contrasts challenge the listeners to make the correct response to the teaching. They are to take the narrow way, chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, to avoid fruitless false prophets, chapter 7, verse 15 to 23, and to build their lives on the words they have heard, chapter 7, verse 24 to 27. Are their lives marked by these traits of the Beatitudes? Do they view the law and the prophets as Jesus does? Concluding Narrative Framework, chapter 7, verse 28 through 29. The crowds are amazed at Jesus' authoritative teaching. Literary structure. Each of the Beatitudes is composed of a statement of who is blessed, quote, blessed are the poor in spirit, end quote, followed by a statement of why the person is blessed, quote, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, end quote. First, the character of the blessed person is highlighted. Then the promise of God to that person is explained. Altogether, there are 9 Beatitudes, chapter 5, verses 3 through 12, and the 9th, chapter 5, verse 11 through 12, being an expansion of the 8th. The first 8 Beatitudes may be divided into 2 groups of 4, with the first group emphasizing the disciples' vertical relationship to God, the second emphasizing the disciples' horizontal relationship to people. The Beatitudes may be displayed chiastically and summarized as follows. Chart 2. Display and Summary of the Beatitudes. Chapter 5, verse 3. The poor in spirit, blessed because theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Unit 2. Chapter 5, verse 4. Mourners, blessed because they will be comforted. Unit 3. Chapter 5, verse 5. Meek, blessed, because they will inherit the earth. Unit 4, chapter 5, verse 6. Hungry, blessed, because they will be filled. Unit 4 prime, chapter 5, verse 7. Merciful, blessed, because they will be mercied. Unit 3 prime, chapter 5, verse 8. Pure, blessed, because they will see God. Unit 2 prime, Matthew chapter 5, verse 9, peacemakers blessed because they will be called the sons of God. And Unit 1 prime, Matthew chapter 5, verse 10, persecuted blessed because theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This chiastic layout of the Beatitudes is indicated by several factors. First, there is an enveloping present tense inclusio. Auton esten he basileia ton uranon, in chapter 5, verse 3 and 10. The similar future divine passives, paraklethesantai and klethesantai, occur in chapter 5, verse 4 and 9. A future active verb with direct objects occurs in chapter 5, verse 5. Aute kleronomesusen tain gain, answered by the future middle verb with direct object in 5:8, autoi tan thean apsantai. In the center of the chiasm, chapters 5, verses 6 and 7, both utilize future divine passives, autoi kortasthesantai, autoi elethesantai. It may also be noted that both halves of the chiasm conclude with a concept of righteousness, chapter 5, verses 6 and 10. And there is an alliteration with the letter pi in Matthew's description of the blessed in the first half. Tokoi penthuntes praes penontes, in chapter 5, verses 3 through 6. Thus, the enveloping idea of blessedness, of presently possessing of the kingdom, chapter 5, verses 3 and 10, is developed primarily by stressing what God's gracious initiative will do for the disciples. Future divine passives, chapter 5, verses 4, 6, 7, and 9, and secondarily by mentioning what the disciples will do in response to that initiative. Future active and middle, chapter 5, verses 5 and 8. The Greek text of Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 through 12 may be laid out similarly. In chart 3, the chiastic structure and the supporting hati clauses are prominent. Also, the elaboration of the 8th Beatitude, chapter 5, verse 10, by chapter 5, verses 11 and 12, is clarified. And here in chapter 3, he gives a visual display of the Greek text. Theological purpose. The theological purpose of the Beatitudes cannot be understood apart from the theological purpose of this Sermon on the Mount as a whole, and there are many divergent approaches to this. Albert Schweitzer's Consequente Eschatologie approach saw the Sermon on the Mount as an interim ethic designed only for what Jesus mistakenly believed would be a brief time before the inbreaking of the apocalyptic judgment. Needless to say, evangelicals find little common ground with the view which posits a mistaken Jesus. Lutheranism tends to take the Sermon on the Mount as a teaching of high standards of the law, which is intended to drive the audience to the gospel. Traditional dispensationalism, similarly, tends to view the Sermon on the Mount as law, not grace, but postpones its primary applicability to the future millennium. But many dispensationalists today are not disposed to the traditional approach. Classic liberal theology took the Sermon on the Mount as a bulwark of the, quote, social gospel, unquote, of human kindness and progress, and in the process drastically overestimated human ability to live by the Sermon on the Mount apart from divine grace. The Anabaptist tradition somewhat simplistically absolutizes the Sermon on the Mount as the standard of ethics for all times and places. Though the above views contain elements of truth, it seems much better to view the Sermon on the Mount in general and the Beatitudes in particular as an ethic for the disciples who live between the two advents of Jesus, the Messiah. The disciples' character traits are the results of the saving rule of God inaugurated through the kingdom message preached at Jesus' first advent. The disciples long for the full manifestation of that saving rule in the future, chapter 6, verse 10. The theological purpose of the Sermon on the Mount in general, and of the Beatitudes in particular, centers in the kingdom of heaven. The phrase, he basileia ton uranon, or the kingdom of heaven, occurs in Matthew chapter 5, verse 3, 10, 19, 20, chapter 7, 21. The kingdom of heaven also occurs in chapter 6, verse 10, and 13 and verse 33. At least three major theological issues surround the kingdom of heaven. The first of these is the relationship of Matthew's characteristic term, quote, the kingdom of heaven, end quote, to the kingdom of God. Though some have attempted to make a distinction here, none is warranted. This is clear from a comparison of the kingdom of heaven in Matthew with the kingdom of God in parallel passages in the Synoptic Gospels. That is, for example, compare Matthew chapter 5:3 with Luke 6:20. Apparently, Matthew uses the term as a metonymy of God's dwelling place for God's name, due to the sensitivity of his audience. Another question concerns the kingdom as God's present rule and/or God's future realm. Here, the answer is certainly conjunctive rather than disjunctive. To handle all the data adequately, one cannot resort to simplistic theories which identify the kingdom either with the future millennium or the present church. Both traditional dispensational theology and traditional covenant theology need to nuance their respective positions along the lines suggested by George Ladd and others. A third question about the kingdom of heaven is its relationship to the church. Traditional dispensationalism's tendency has been to separate the two, and traditional covenant theologies to equate them. Neither of these positions will do in view of the data in Matthew, especially chapter 16, verses 18 through 19. Again, Ladd's articulation is a beneficial place to begin discussion of a more nuanced position. Now the question of how all this impacts the interpretation of the Beatitudes must be considered. The first and eighth Beatitude contain the same enveloping promise, hati auton esten he basileia ton uranon, quote, theirs is the kingdom of heaven, end quote. Just how significant is the fact that the verb is present tense? Scholars as diverse as Beasley Murray and Toussaint attempt to minimize any emphasis on the presence of the kingdom here. Beasley Murray argues from the future orientation of the context, and Toussaint views the present tense as futuristic or proleptic. However, one wonders why a futuristic present would be used since the context is already dominated by future tenses. More than this, the whole thrust of the Beatitudes is upon the present blessedness of the disciples, and this blessedness is rather hollow if their actual experience of this blessing is postponed until millennial times. Therefore, it is better to take the present tense as a simple statement of the disciples' present experience of the kingdom. Granted, their present experience of the kingdom is partial, but it is genuine. Granted, the disciples' hope is primarily in the future eschaton, but they have already experienced its saving power. God has already begun his eschatological work of blessing those who acknowledge their spiritual bankruptcy and hunger for spiritual fullness. In the eschaton, they will be filled full. In all this, it becomes clear that the Beatitudes are primarily eschatological blessings of the kingdom and not requirements for entrance into the kingdom. One should not view the Beatitudes as God's challenge for disciples to perform up to a certain standard in order to earn his approval. That would lead either to hopeless despair or to self-congratulation and spiritual pride, qualities which are antithetical to the character traits which are blessed. Instead, one must view these character traits as visible fruit of the work of God through the dynamic of good news of God's saving rule. Beatitudes are not imperatives, though they implicitly call upon those blessed by God's gracious initiative to cultivate the character traits which have become theirs by God's grace. This is not unlike the more explicit, quote, be what you are, end quote, pattern often noted in Pauline ethical teaching. For example, Ephesians chapter 4, verses 20 through 5:2. Or Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. With this theological perspective in mind, it is now time to examine the individual Beatitudes. Exegetical comments. Foundational to the exegesis of the Beatitudes is the meaning of Makarios, quote, blessed, end quote. The word, quote, beatitudes, end quote, is related to the Latin beatus, quote, happy, end quote. Sometimes the beatitudes are called, quote, macarisms, end quote, based on Makarios. In the Septuagint, Makarios often translates ashrei, an emphatic exclamation meaning, quote, oh, the happiness of, end quote. Beatitudes have their background both in wisdom and apocalyptic literature and are found regularly in the Bible. For example, Psalm 1:1, Psalm 32:1, Proverbs 3:13, Daniel 12:12, Romans 14:22, and Revelation 1, verse 3. To be blessed is to receive God's approval, favor, endorsement, congratulations. Quote, blessed, end quote, should not be understood merely in the sense of, quote, happy, end quote, since happiness is a vague idea, often with a shallow emotional ring to it. No doubt, divine blessing produces deep joy and genuine happiness in its human recipients, but the focus is on the originator of the blessing. God initiates blessing by graciously condescending to save his people. His people respond to his initiative by blessing him in thanks and praise for that grace and by living obediently. As noted in the discussion of literary structure, the Beatitudes are best viewed as two sets of four, chapter 5, verses 3 through 6, and chapter 5, verses 7 through 10, plus an expansion of the final one, Matthew chapter 5, verses 11 through 12. Evidently, Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16 is meant to show that those who manifest the character traits of the Beatitudes will impact their world as salt and light. The first set, section 1, 1 through 4 below, seems to describe those qualities which assure one approval of relating to God, awareness of spiritual poverty, mourning over sin, humility, desire for deeper experience of righteousness. The second set, section 2, 1 through 4 below, describes the qualities which assure one of divine approval in relating to people, extending mercy, internal integrity, making peace, and enduring persecution. 1:1. Quote, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, end quote. Chapter 5, verse 3. God's approval does not come to those who boast of their spiritual riches. Rather, his endorsement is for those who admit their poverty. In the Old Testament, there is repeated reference to anavim, people whose economic distress left them with nothing to rely upon except God, Leviticus chapter 19, verses 9 to 15, and verses 32 through 33, Deuteronomy 15, 4, 7, and 11, Psalm chapter 37, verses 10 through 17, Proverbs 16, verses 18 through 19, Isaiah chapter 66, verses 1 and 2, Jeremiah chapter 22, verses 15 to 17, and Amos chapter 2, verses 6 through 8. Their distress was due to such problems as death in the family, physical handicap, advancing age, military defeat, social injustice, or alien status. This seems to be the Old Testament background of Jesus' words, but spiritual poverty should be acknowledged by everyone, not just those who have adverse circumstances. Material prosperity should not deaden one's sensitivity to spiritual poverty. Those who realize that they have nothing spiritually are the only ones who really have anything. Section 1.2. Quote, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted, end quote. Chapter 5, verse 4. Here, Jesus indicates that those who mourn receive God's approval. People mourn over such things as disaster, injustice, unbelief, and persecution. But here, the context indicates mourning over one's own sinfulness, whether in thoughts or actions, omissions or commissions. So this beatitude fits with the testimony of such great saints as Isaiah in Isaiah 6, and Job in Job 42. At first, this may sound like some sort of cruel, sadistic joke, appealing only to masochistic types. It is as if Jesus is saying that those who are unhappy are happy. But in reality, Jesus is exposing the error of superficial, self-centered living. Genuine realism, not false optimism, is true bliss for the follower of Jesus, for it will lead to ultimate comfort. Section 1.3, quote, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth," end quote. Chapter 5, verse 5, quote, "Meekness is not weakness," end quote. So goes the cliche. But true meekness is unassuming humility, which places total dependence upon God and renounces self-effort to achieve one's wants and needs. It is this kind of person who will inherit the earth. See also chapter 19, verses 28 through 29, chapter 25, 34. Once again, Jesus goes against the grain of human pride and modern culture by asserting that the meek, not the yuppies, the militarists, the financial tycoons, or the holier-than-thou types, will inherit the earth. Section 1.4, quote, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled," end quote. Chapter 5, verse 6. God approves of those who long for right relationship with Him, not those who mistakenly think that they already have achieved it. Righteousness here should not be viewed in the Pauline sense, Romans chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, etc., of legal innocence before God, based on faith in Jesus' vicarious sacrifice. Rather, the emphasis is on ethical righteousness, the upright lifestyle. See also chapter 1, verse 19, chapter 3, 15, 5, 10, verse 20, and verse 45, chapter 6, verses 1 and 33. Those who realize their lack in this area, rather than those who boast of their attainments, will receive what they long for. We should think here not only of personal righteousness, but also of social righteousness. Section 2, number 1. Quote, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy," end quote. Chapter 5, verse 7. God's approval comes to those who relate to others with pity plus action. While grace pardons the guilty, mercy relieves the miserable. Matthew repeatedly stresses that the theme of mercy is important for the disciple of Jesus. Chapter 6, verse 2, chapter 9, verse 27 and 36, chapter 15, verse 22, chapter 17, verse 15, and chapter 20, verse 30. In contrast, mercy is not present where isolationism, 9:13, legalism, chapter 12, verse 7, or trivialism, chapter 23:23, are the rules of life. Compare Hosea 6:6 and Micah 6:8. Those who have experienced God's mercy will show it to others. Compare Matthew chapter 18, verses 21 through 35, and thus demonstrate their destiny as those who will yet receive mercy at the last day. Section 2.2, quote, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God," end quote. Chapter 5, verse 8. Purity of heart involves integrity, transparency, and freedom from corruption. It is crucial to note that the purity which God approves is heart purity. The Pharisees were models of an external, rule-oriented purity which Jesus utterly rejected and condemned. His disciples have experienced the power of the kingdom, which purifies from the inside out. Thus, they must cultivate integrity in their private, intellectual, and emotional, and volitional lives. See Matthew 5:28, 6:21, 9:4, 11:29, 12:34, 13:15, and 19, chapter 15, verses 8, 18, 19, 18, 35, 22, 37, and 23, 26. Only such people may expect to see God. Section 2.3, quote, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the sons of God," end quote. Chapter 5, verse 9. God in Christ is the ultimate peacemaker. Compare Romans chapter 5, verse 1, Ephesians 2:14-15, and Colossians 1:20. Those who will be called his children already bear a filial likeness or family resemblance to their heavenly Father. See chapter 5, verses 43-48. The experience of peace with God enables Jesus' disciples to seek the cessation of their hostility with people. While the gospel itself may offend some people and lead to hostility, chapter 10, verse 34, Jesus' disciples actively seek harmonious relationship with others. In this age of individual, ethnic, and national aggression, Jesus' reminder that peacemakers, not warmongers, have God's approval is sorely needed. Section 2.4, quote, "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven," end quote. Chapter 5, verse 10. With the second mention of the phrase, quote, "theirs is the kingdom of heaven," end quote, see Matthew 5:3, the Beatitudes will have come full circle. The chief marks of those who already live under God's rule are humility toward God and mercy toward other people. One might expect such humble, merciful people to be valued highly by their fellow human beings, but such is not the case. Jesus preeminently displayed these characteristics, and he is viciously persecuted to the point of death, chapter 23, verses 31-32. He warns his disciples that they will receive similar treatment, Matthew chapter 10, verses 16-42, and chapter 24, verses 9-14. Section 3.1. Now Jesus explains that the disciples described in chapter 5, 3-10, will have a definite influence upon this world. This should put to rest any notion that discipleship is merely a private matter between a person and God. First, in Matthew 5, 11-12, Jesus expands his beatitude on persecution, chapter 5, verse 10, by pointing out that insults and slander may occur because of his disciples' connection to himself. When this occurs, the disciples are in good company with the prophets and may expect a great reward. Thus, the disciples' influence on the world may be unappreciated. Section 3.2. Second, in chapter 5, verses 13-16, Jesus uses two vivid pictures to speak of his disciples' influence. They are salt, chapter 5, verse 13, and light, chapter 5, verses 14-16. As salt, they will purify and preserve their society if only they retain their saltiness. As light, their good deeds will result in praise going to their Father, if only they display that light prominently for all to see. Conclusion. The character traits of the kingdom rule are chiefly humility toward God and mercy toward people. By God's grace, these traits are present in principle in the lives of his people. Yet God's people must cultivate these traits so that they are present in fact. In a world which values pride over humility and aggression over mercy, Jesus' disciples are, in the words of Stott, Christian counterculture. As Jesus' disciples cultivate the counterculture qualities of the Beatitudes, they have not only the teachings of their Lord, but also his life to consider. It has been suggested by Waltke that Jesus, the Messiah, is in reality the blessed man of Psalm 1. In the enconium of Hebrews chapters 11 and 12, the author of Hebrews viewed Jesus as the ultimate example of the life of faith. Peter, likewise, did not hesitate to speak of Jesus as the disciples' example. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21. Similarly, in Matthew, Jesus is the one whose life models kingdom values in relating to God and people. Matthew chapter 5, verses 3-12, has several echoes of Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1-9, a text which extols the work of the Messiah under the power of the Spirit. Compare Matthew chapter 11, verse 5, Luke chapter 4, 18. He identified with those who were poor in spirit. For example, Matthew chapter 9, verses 9-12. He mourned over Israel's needs. Matthew chapter 9, verse 36, 14, 14, and 23, 37. He lived as the epitome of meekness. Matthew chapter 11, 29. He fulfilled the righteousness of the Old Testament. Matthew chapter 3, verse 15 and chapter 5, verse 17. His relationships to people were similarly exemplary as he demonstrated mercy. Matthew chapter 9, verse 36 and 14:14. Integrity, Matthew chapter 27, verse 59 through 60. And reconciliation, Matthew chapter 4, verses 23 through 24, and 8, verses 16 through 17. In spite of all Jesus' righteousness, he was persecuted to the point of execution. Matthew chapter 9, verse 34, 10:25, and 12:14. In all this, he lived as well as taught the values of the kingdom, the Beatitudes. Thus, his disciples did not merely ascribe to an abstract theory of values. They walked in the steps of one who practiced those values and said, "Take up my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." Mayer puts it like this: "In the end, then, the Beatitudes are the autobiography of Jesus, a perfect self-portrait by the Master. Jesus, the meek teacher of wisdom and meek king of the universe, Jesus crucified and risen, is the only fully happy man who ever lived. We disciples slowly learn his path to happiness as we walk his way of wisdom, his way of the cross. Happy are those who discover on the way, like a treasure hidden in a field, the Christology hidden in the Beatitudes."